This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other senior figures from the ruling party are still detained after an early morning raid. This move came after days of escalating tension between the civilian government and the powerful military that stirred fears of a coup in the aftermath of an election the army says was fraudulent. Myanmar military commander-in-chief, Senior General Ming Aung Hlaing, on Wednesday told military personnel that the country's constitution should be repealed if it was not abided by, citing previous instances where charters had been abolished by Myanmar. The Myanmar's Election Commission on Thursday rejected the military's allegations of vote fraud, saying there were no errors big enough to affect the credibility of the vote. Since then, the United States has chimed in, warning Myanmar to reverse course following the report to the country and the military had arrested its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Somalia's government announced the end of a seven-hour deadly siege after a suspected suicide car bomb exploded Sunday in Somalia's capital, followed by a shootout between militants and security forces at a hotel causing at least nine deaths. The militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab, which is linked to Al-Qaeda and often carries out bombings in its war on Somalia's government, claimed responsibility via its radio station. The incident happened in the busy Kilometer 4 area of Mogadishu. Reuters, a journalist, saw security forces besiege the area where cars are inspected en route to the airport and where politicians regularly gather at the police spokesman. I said that many people had been rescued from the Hotel Afrique. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Russian police detained more than 5,000 people Sunday at unauthorized rallies nationwide in support of jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Authorities had said in advance that the rallies were illegal and would be broken up. In a massive show of force, police imposed a sweeping security lockdown in the heart of Moscow, sealing off streets to pedestrians near the Kremlin, closing metro stations, and deploying hundreds of riot police as snow fell. At one point, a column of protesters marched toward the prison in northern Moscow, where Navalny is being held, chanting, "Let him go." In another scene, a crowd raised its hands above. We're not your enemies. U.S. President Donald Trump, I should say Joe Biden, is inviting to the White House a group of 10 Republican senators who have proposed spending about one-third of what he is seeking in coronavirus aid. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Sunday that Biden spoke with the leader of the group, Senator Susan Collins. The invitation to meet in the coming days came hours after the lawmakers had sent Biden a letter urging him to negotiate rather than try to ram through his $1.9 trillion package solely on Democratic votes. Hundreds of Brazilians took to the streets Sunday in a fresh round of protest against President Jair Bolsonaro over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Bolsonaro, who tested positive for the coronavirus last summer, has been routinely criticized by scientists and health experts for not enacting measures that would minimize the spread of the disease. Protesters in Rio de Janeiro paraded in cars and on bikes shouting for Bolsonaro's removal. Demonstrations also took place in Sao Paulo and outside federal buildings in the capital. Brazil has recorded the second highest number of deaths and the third highest number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the world. That's according to data from the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. And Brazil wasn't the only place that saw COVID-related protest. Thousands of protesters faced off with police in riot gear in Vienna Sunday at the site of a banned far-right demonstration against coronavirus restrictions. Demonstrators protested against the lockdown amid the spread of coronavirus disease in Lima, Peru. And in the U.S., just Saturday in Los Angeles, protesters rallying against COVID-19 vaccines, but lockdowns and mass gathered gates at Dodger Stadium and its mass vaccination center were shut down temporarily. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Al-Shabaab militants launched their latest attack on Somalia's capital.
They have used a DBIED explosion, and there were about four militants Al-Shabaab that went inside the hotel. As we speak right now, the operation is still ongoing. We don't know the actual casualties.
Burundi's government will attempt to reset the clock on media freedom today, Monday. We'll also hear from exiled Burundian journalists. The African Union launches a website to track threats against journalists. And Gambia's president launches a new political party ahead of the 2021 presidential election.
I am convinced that in urging me to form a political party to contest the 2021 presidential election, the people of this nation must have assessed me and my performance.
And a discussion this morning with the author of a book on dual citizenship in Liberia. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somali security expert says Al-Shabaab militants are capitalizing on governance and security vacuums in Somalia as the backdrop for their latest attacks. The militants detonated a car bomb and engaged in a gun battle at a hotel in the capital Mogadishu on Sunday. Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed, a Somali member of parliament and former security minister, says Al-Shabaab always launches attacks when there is political instability, particularly with the current uncertainty about the next Somali election.
Al-Shabaab has attacked a Afrique hotel. They have used a DBIED explosion, and there were about four militants Al-Shabaab that went inside the hotel. As we speak right now, the operation is still ongoing. We don't know the actual casualties until the operation is concluded.
What has been the response of the security forces?
Well, Al-Shabaab always takes advantage and capitalizes when there's political conflict within the government, within the political elites. And right now there's an impasse on the electoral process. We knew that they would eventually take advantage of that and capitalize it to their advantage. And today it happened, even though this morning I have received an intelligence report probably being issued by the international community that said that Al-Shabaab is about to attack hotels and restaurants that are mostly frequented by government officials as well as security personnel. So it was an alert that was warning people to avoid those areas. And that was only this morning. I mean, this attack happened about 6-7 hours after I have received that alert.
You mentioned election. Could you explain what is the relationship of election to the current attack?
Well, actually, every time there's the potential of political instability, Al-Shabaab capitalizes that, because when there's a political conflict within the leadership, the issue is by 8th of February, the term of the president ends. And the date for the election hasn't been announced yet. So there's a stalemate of when the election is to be held. And because of that, the government is diverted its attention from security-related activities. And these vacuums that the government creates are always being taken advantage by Al-Shabaab. Every time there's a political instability, every time there's a political disagreement, Al-Shabaab attacks major hotels in the city of Mogadishu.
Are they responding to a drawdown in U.S. security enforcement in Somalia?
Well, it actually adds the problem. The U.S. has been providing logistics as well as intelligence support to AMISOM. It has been doing drone and strikes against Al-Shabaab, high-value targets. The departure of the U.S. Army has actually contributed to this as well, because Al-Shabaab have been hiding because of the airstrikes.
Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed is a Somali member of parliament and former security minister. You are speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. Today, Monday, could be a big day in Burundi in terms of government media relations. The country's National Communication Council is expected to meet today with media houses and journalists at the urging of President Evariste Ndayishimiye to iron out differences with media organizations that have been under government sanctions. Wele Nyamitwe is chief of the Information and Communications Division at the Burundian State House.
If you can recall, President Ndayishimiye's slogan during the campaign was "Turi kumwe twese birashoboka," which means in English, if we are all together, it's possible. So he has kept the same slogan. Therefore, it is for this reason that he is mobilizing everyone in Burundi and outside Burundi around this ideal. Basically, the president considers journalists as a significant segment of the population. In other words, the head of state resets the counters to zero and wants journalists and media houses to bring their contribution.
There's a host of Burundian media houses that were closed, and their journalists fled into exile, accused of playing a role in the 2015 alleged attempted coup. I am talking about the owner of Bonisha Radio and also the CEO of Iwaku newspaper. Will their situation be discussed at today's meeting?
I think that it will be up to the National Communication Council to analyze the matter.
As you know, in 2018, the Burundian government, under the late President Pierre Nkurunziza, banned VOA and the BBC. The government also prohibited local and foreign journalists operating in Burundi from directly contributing to the VOA and the BBC. Will today's meeting also cover the VOA and the BBC ban?
Mr. James Batty, I consider myself in a very bad position to give you details about which media house will or will not be invited to discuss its situation with the council.
Wele Nyamitwe is chief of the Information Communications Division at the Burundian State House. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. The organization of more than 100 independent exiled Burundian journalists says it welcomes President Evariste Ndayishimiye's desire to iron out differences with media organizations that have been banned or sanctioned under the administration of his predecessor, Pierre Nkurunziza, as a step in the right direction. However, Innocent Muhozi, director of TV Renaissance, says journalists will not be free to do their work if other Burundian citizens are not free to express their opinions.
We could be invited to that meeting because we are not sure that we are invited, but we suppose that we are also invited. So the statement and the injunction that President Ndayishimiye gave the National Council of Communication is a good step in the right direction because it could help to start a dialogue that we have been asking for years to find a solution to the problems that we as independent media have. But also we think the only way to find solution to the problems that Burundi face today is dialogue. So we think it's a good step. We wait to see the really will that they could have or not. We don't know where they put the restriction or not. You know, we are supposed to be wanted by the justice in Burundi. Some of us have been tortured. Some of us have been killed. We are more than 100 in exile. We don't know what could be the guarantees for our security if we agree to go back. But what we say at that point is that it's a good step to start a dialogue, but this dialogue must include all the problems that are there, but also include the other segments of society, civil society, politicians, and other actors, so that we all feel free and secure in our country and go back to that country.
Innocent, was your group consulted or were you invited to attend this meeting?
We are not sure yet that we are part of the meeting. We're not sure. We said that we are ready to send a representative, and we'll try to send a colleague who is in Burundi with our position and see if they will come to let him participate to that meeting. But we are not sure yet at that time.
Overall, do you think this is a positive development?
If it is clear as we expect it, as we hope it, if we are part of this dialogue, it's a good step. But there are a lot of problems that we have to discuss with the government so that we see if the bad situation that we are living as journalists in exile, as journalists in the country, but as also citizens in exile, as citizens in the country, many thousands of people in prison because of their opinion. So I think it's very important to have a dialogue about all those topics because, you know, we cannot be free to work as journalists in the country if other citizens are not free to express their opinions. This is one of the questions we would like to put on the table in this dialogue.
Innocent, thank you very much. It's always nice to talk with you.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Innocent Muhoozi is the exile director of TV Renaissance in Burundi. You are speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 1st. Threats to African journalists are nothing new, but the African Union is launching a website to track and monitor threats against journalists in a bid to improve protection of media workers and support the right of freedom of expression. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Six African journalists were killed in 2020, according to the International Federation of Journalists. Countless more were threatened, arrested, harassed, and censored, according to several media freedom and human rights groups. That, the African Union is now saying, has to stop. And to do that, they're making use of journalists' most powerful tool, facts. A new AU website, www.safetyofjournalistsinafrica.africa, launched Friday and will now track threats to African journalists. Here's Jovial Runtao, chairman of the African Editors Forum, invoking the memories of fallen colleagues.
We stand on the shoulders of these giants, these heroes of the media in Africa, in whose name we today launch this platform that is designed to help end the harassment, detention, and even murder of journalists just for doing their work. In some of our beloved continent, freedom of the media, freedom of expression, access to information is a matter of life and death.
Runtao and his colleagues readily admit that journalists are often the irritating characters who lurk in the halls of power to shout tough questions at important people. There are also figures like Zimbabwean investigative journalist Hopewell Chinono, who was recently granted bail after 3 weeks in prison. He was charged with communicating falsehoods after he tweeted that police had beaten an infant to death while enforcing COVID-19 lockdown regulations. As South African President Cyril Ramaphosa argues, you don't have to like journalists or their work to support this initiative.
It requires that we vigorously defend the right of journalists to do their work, to write, to publish, and to also broadcast what they like, even if we disagree with some or all of it. Africa is on the march to entrench a culture of human rights, of democracy, gender equality, inclusion, peace, prosperity, security for all our citizens, and unfettered media freedom and independence. The digital platform for the safety of journalists in Africa is an important tool in promoting the safety of journalists and other media workers across Africa.
But media freedom advocates were quick to point out that doesn't mean journalists are without responsibilities. At the virtual launch of the website, media freedom advocates spoke of Félicien Kabuga, founder of Rwanda's infamous Radio Télévision Libre de Mille Collines. That's the broadcaster whose reporters actively encouraged Rwandans to participate in the 1994 genocide that killed more than 800,000 people. Kabuga's use of the platform to spew hatred and incite violence has led him to prison in The Hague. The head of the AU African Governance Architecture Secretariat, Salah Hamad, says the AU draws a direct line between honest journalism and robust, peaceful societies.
So when we are talking about the rights of people, the rights of human and people's rights in Africa, we cannot really exclude media freedom as well as right to expression and right to freedom of expression as well as right to information. And the African Union, in its constitutive act, clearly indicated that the African Union in totality is very supportive, of course, of the promotion and protection of these rights.
The platform will help keep a focus on continuing violations, like the January 19th shooting death of an Ethiopian broadcaster in the conflict-racked Tigray region. The Independent Ethiopian Human Rights Council says that the journalist Dawit Kabede Araya and a friend were killed execution style by security forces. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Gambian President Adamman Barrow says the era of dictatorship is over in the Gambia. He spoke over the weekend when he launched his National People's Party, the NPP. Barrow came to power in December of 2016, replacing the longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh. Pandera Umbaya reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
President Barrow came to power in December of 2016 after promising democratic reforms, term limit for the presidency, and combating official corruption. He also made a promise of staying in power for 3 years and hand over the country to an interim president, but he has since walked away from that promise. He has set up his own political party, the National People's Party, NPP.
I am convinced that in urging me to form a political party to contest the 2021 presidential election, the people of this nation must have assessed me and my performance. Furthermore, I am convinced that your confidence in me as a nation is based on sound reasoning and wise judgment. Hence your call for me to lead this historic voyage.
In 4 years of his rule, the country has witnessed what observers call democratic freedom, freedom of expression, with the ban of media houses, political parties, and relative peace, though the country is still grappling with corruption.
Ladies and gentlemen, the NPP is the outcome of the commitment to sustain the change that has brought about in 2016. And the public outcry for freedom, justice, peace, progress, and dignity, as well as for fundamental rights and liberties.
Thousands of people graced the occasion at the Independence Stadium in Bakau. Barrow says the NPP would become the party that would unite and foster national development in the country.
This new party, the NPP, represents the present and the future, and it is here for all Gambian citizens within the framework of a new political consciousness and a new direction.
His critics have accused him of betraying the change by allowing former Jammeh enablers to work in his administration. Barrow knows that the days of dictatorship are over in the Gambia.
We believe in democracy for good governance, as it is defined by the law and approved by the people. We do not believe in any form of governance that contravenes the Gambia's shared ideals and values. Accordingly, we denounce and reject all forms of dictatorship and degrading treatment of human beings or communities. We believe that all are equal before the law, and all human beings have the same fundamental rights to life and good living.
The NPP launching came at a time when the country has been witnessing spikes in coronavirus cases. Meanwhile, President Barrow has promised to revamp Gambia's health sector and to create an enabling environment for the private sector. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A new book by Dr. Roptel Nijay Pele explores the history of dual citizenship and its possible future in Liberia. In development, dual citizenship and its discontent in Africa, Pele looks at many aspects of citizenship in Liberia. She discusses the issue of land ownership, which she tells Ricky Schreier is one of the most contentious issues underpinning citizenship in Liberia.
I actually explore this quite extensively in my book, Development, Dual Citizenship, and Its Discontents in Africa. There's even a chapter entitled, Give Me Your Land or I'll Shoot. And it's emblematic of a story that I tell, a historical story about the first encounter between the American Colonization Society, comprising of white pseudo-abolitionists who repatriated free blacks as well as formerly enslaved blacks who wanted to leave the United States in exchange for their freedom. So this story is of indigenous populations encountering these white pseudo-abolitionists and being coerced into selling land that they actually thought of as a communal way of looking at land. So one of the most important entitlements of citizenship in Liberia today is the ability to own land. And this is largely a result of Liberia's history of settler state formation, what I talked about a little bit earlier. Now, this conflation of private property ownership and citizenship and belonging was in direct contradiction to how indigenous populations at the time of Liberia's inception of its independence in 1847, and even indigenous populations today, how they conceive of citizenship. Indigenous populations actually believed that they were the communal custodians of land.
How have struggles over citizenship impacted Liberia's development policy?
While some see it as a zero-sum game, reproducing inequalities between those who might have and those who may not have very much, others see it as enabling development by perhaps expanding the scope of what a Liberian actually is.
Given your extensive research, what is your position on the current debate over dual citizenship in Liberia?
So even though the Afrobarometer surveys that were conducted in Liberia in 2012 and 2018 showed that Liberians in the country are still very staunchly opposed or have misgivings about dual citizenship, we had a national referendum in December 2020, which really shows that dual citizenship might be inevitable for Liberia. Liberia at the moment is one of seven countries in the continent of Africa that does not formally recognize dual citizenship. For the most part, even though many of the referendum results were invalid, the ballots were invalid because of a variety of different reasons, what I saw in terms of trends and looking at the national referendum results is most people generally believe that dual citizenship is a good idea in principle.
That was Dr. Robtel Nijepele, assistant professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science. She is also the author of Development, Dual Citizenship, and Its Discontents in Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the teams who have qualified for the semi-final places in the CAF African Nations Championship currently holding in Cameroon. Defending CHAN champions, Atlas Lions of Morocco, went through to the semi-finals on Sunday after a convincing 3-1 win against a 10-man Zambian side. Zambia were reduced by one player after Zakaria Chilungushi was sent off for a bad foul on Abdillah Hafidi after 20 minutes of play. Morocco will now face host Cameroon at the semi-final stage on February the 3rd at the Limbe Omine Sports Stadium. Host Cameroon had earlier on Saturday qualified for the semi-final after beating two-time winners DR Congo 2-1 on Saturday night. The Indomitable Lions came back from a goal down to win the quarterfinal match at the iconic Japoma Stadium in Douala to the delight of the home fans. The result means Cameroon will face Morocco in Wednesday's semi-final at the Limpe Stadium. Lawrence Nikedia is a Cameroonian sports journalist based in Yaoundé. I asked him to share his thoughts on the semi-final pairings between Morocco and Cameroon.
The semi-final pairing between Cameroon and Morocco is a perfect one because we have the host nation versus the title holder. I mean, Cameroon is going to base itself on its fighting spirit, on its resilience, and Morocco on its technicality. These are two nations that are going to fight for a place in the finals.
Meanwhile, the Eagles of Mali stopped Congo in penalties to storm into the semi-final after a goalless draw in 120 minutes of regulation and extra time. Mali was sharper in penalties, winning 5-4 at the Amadou Ahidjo Stadium in Yaoundé. It is the second time Mali will be getting to the semi-final stage of a CHAN tournament after finishing as runner-ups in 2016. The fourth and final team to go through were Guinea, that defeated Rwanda 1-0 in the match. We saw both sides finish with 10 men at the Limbe Stadium. Guinea will face neighbors Mali on Wednesday as both sides jostle for a spot in the finals. Once again, Cameroonian-based sports journalist Lawrence Nekedi describes the Guinea and Mali's match as a West African derby that will be too close to call.
It will be West African derby between two nations who are technically very good at the ball. Mali had to suffer to go right through the penalty shootout in order to qualify for the semifinals, while Guinea edged its opponent Rwanda 1-0 to book its ticket for the semis. So this encounter is an all West African derby, and it's very difficult to predict.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great day. And that's it for this Monday, February 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barton.